Brembo Red, High Performance Podcast.
Thanks for joining us on the Brembo Red Podcast. I'm Dan Sandberg from Brembo, and during the next two or three episodes of Brembo Red, we'll be broadcasting from SEMA, the Specialty Equipment Market Association show in Las Vegas. We'll be at the LA Auto Show, and we'll also be just down the street of the Charlotte Motor Speedway with some fantastic guests from the world of motorsports and automotive. But first, I'm glad to be at SEMA, and if my voice sounds a little bit shaky, is because I was in the ultimate fun haver yesterday. What am I talking about? I'm talking about a souped-up F-150 vehicle, and the best part about it is Vaughn Gittin Jr. was the one who was driving that truck. Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Glad you got to get in the passenger seat. You know, we're out here all week giving rides at Ford out front and putting smiles on faces. And that truck, you learned why it's called the ultimate fun haver.
Oh, man. It was fun. And, you know, I go to SEMA year after year after year, and I come down the little monorail there, and I see all those cars and trucks spinning around and smoke everywhere and a lot of excitement, engine sounds, rubber, and I get so excited about it, and it's unbelievable to be inside the smoke, if you will.
Yeah, for sure. You know, that truck drifts, it jumps. You know, I'm out here, my teammate Chelsea DeNofa and my off-road teammate Lauren Healy, and we're just having a blast, you know, showing performance, showing fun, and hopefully inspiring, you know, next generation of drivers and enthusiasts.
How did you get into this business?
Ever since I can remember, you know, I've just always loved cars. I've just had a magnetism towards them. And when I was 4 years old, my father got me a little junky yard cart go-kart, and it had this little paddle brake that, you know, pull it up and this little paddle went down on the tires to brake it. I remember going like as fast as I could through the industrial parks and like pulling the paddle brake and just loving that feeling of like skidding and sliding. And then through my teenage years, skateboarding, riding BMX, racing motocross, but always still had a love for cars. When I was 18, I got a rear wheel drive car. A friend of mine crashed it. I bought it, fixed it. And that car was a 240SX, which effectively, as I started going down the road of hooking it up and tuning it, came across drifting. And I just fell in love with this sport, you know, where you can show your personality and style from behind the wheel. It was like skateboarding with cars to me. And so I went to, you know, some organized events and fell in love with the community, the culture, and I really enjoyed wrenching on my car and just making it better and trying new things and just a big passion. At the time, I was a computer nerd. I was in IT, so I was making good money, and I spent all my money on my car, effectively just chased a dream.
All right, for those of our listeners who don't quite understand exactly what the art of drifting is about, can you tell them what is drifting and what makes a good drift? What should we be looking for if you see a competition
sure.
like that?
Sure. Yeah, you know, drifting is the fastest growing motorsport in the world, and I run in Formula Drift, which is the premier top-level series in the world. At the grassroots level, right, I think it's important to share grassroots versus pro level. At the grassroots level, it's fun. It's a car meet with your friends where you're driving your vehicle, but you're not just driving it. You're sliding sideways, slaying tires. You know, basically, at that level, there's no rules. You go out, have fun, show your style. Some guys drive a big angle. Some guys drive really fast. It just all depends. You know, some guys are really committed. Some guys are conservative. Again, style and personality. Now take it to the pro league, right? You're talking Formula Drift, where now you're here to compete. You're here to win. So the way that it works is you show up and you first do some practice, then you go into qualifying. And there's only 40 licensed drivers in the world. So through qualifying, those drivers will be delved down into 32 that go into the main battles. And the judges are looking for line, commitment, overall impact, and angle as well. They set up a course that has zones or clipping points. And effectively, you have to run this defined course as close as you can to the zones, as close as you can to the clipping points, with as much commitment and angle as and speed as possible. So basically, they're narrowing down, you know, it's a score from 0 to 100. They narrow that down. Once qualifying's over, you're put into like an NCAA bracket, where 32nd qualifier goes against first, 31st qualifier goes against second, and so on. So during the battle rounds, each driver gets a chance to lead and follow. That completes a round. So as the lead driver, it's your job to run that 100-point qualifying run. And as the chase driver, it's your job to basically mimic and be on that lead driver's door. It's effectively a dogfight with cars. Then you switch, and same thing. And the judges judge based on that battle. If they can't choose a winner, then you go one more time until there is a winner. For a spectator, it's controlled chaos, sensory overload. It's literally like a train wreck waiting to happen at any moment. You got, you know, 2,000-3,000 horsepower on the track, door to door, inches from walls, and it's just it's insane. And for a driver, for me, you know, I've been doing it for 17 years. To do anything for 17 years, it's got to be worth it. And for me, it's always changing, and it's just the biggest challenge mentally, physically. And it just brings the best out of you, and I enjoy that.
Now, these cars have dual brake systems, at least, right? Some have three brake systems, from what I understand. And you're basically alternating between the front and the rear brakes to kind of give you motion, non-motion, and actually make those movements, right?
Yeah, so, you know, in drifting, it's all about weight control, like anything sport, but, you know, you need it to be immediate. So we use the brakes to control the weight and change direction and transition the car. So the foot brake is just like a regular brake system, controls the front and rear brake, the base system. We use a bias. We'll put a little bit more towards the front because sometimes when you're up on somebody's door, you need a left foot brake and control the car without getting out of throttle because the car has so much grip. If you don't stay committed, it'll just hook up and then you lose. It'll straighten up and you lose. And then the other system is the handbrake. The handbrake is connected sometimes to a set of separate calipers in the rear. A lot of guys are going back to just doing a pass-through into the brake system to save the weight of the calipers in the rear. That's how technical and crazy it's getting these days. You know, you're using the handbrake to help rotate the car, using the foot brake to help you, you know, slow down the ability to left foot brake. We rely on very high initial torque. We don't get a ton of weight in the cars, but, you know, we're using that to do a lot of weight transfer and fully control the vehicle, you know, at every moment, and brakes are a huge key to that.
So you've turned this love of racing and the competition actually into a business. You have a business called RTR. Tell us what all that's about.
You know, I've been obviously drifting for a very long time, very, you know, infused in the Mustang community, in the Ford world. You know, I'm very committed. I love Ford, and I've been working with them for 12 years. And early on when I got into the Mustang world, I started looking at ways to personalize my Mustang. This was 2005 when I got my first car we were building. I very quickly realized that there was nothing that really spoke to me as far as aftermarket offerings. You know, the wheel styles, the parts that were going on the cars were like things I felt like my father or grandfather would want, and there was nothing that spoke to me. And when I say me, I mean, I think I speak for a generation. I mean, I came from the import side, fell in love with the Mustang, and I felt that there was just a big gap between what was perceived to be cool in Mustang, but what my generation was not really Mustang fans. I wanted people to love Mustang, and I wanted something for myself that would make me proud to be like, yeah, this is my personalized Mustang. So that inspired me to start a company called RTR. RTR stands for Ready to Rock. For me, it's something I always say, like, I'm ready to rock. You ready to rock? Let's go, you know? But what it means within the brand is that our vehicles are ready for anything. So in 2010, we launched our first Mustang as a dealer-installed package. Modern aggressive performance styling and tactical performance. Most all of our vehicles have fully adjustable suspension, the ability for you to fine tune the car for what you want to do, whether you want to just drive the street and have a nice comfortable ride, whether you want to go hit the twisties, back roads, go enjoy some road courses, and of course, you know, drifting. And the things we've been doing have been growing very, very well. We've done a lot of really high profile projects. We built Chemblock's Unicorn RTR, my RTRX. We've done a lot of special projects for Ford, and we launched our RTR F-150 last year. We launched our Ranger RTR this year. You know, we just have eyes set on a really big future, but, you know, we're an aftermarket OEM plus company. We build really high quality products, just try to put smiles on our customers' faces.
You know, you've been just about everywhere. You've raced open wheels. You touched even in NASCAR, even some top 10 finishes in the torturous. Is that a good term for it? Probably.
Absolutely.
The king of the hammers.
It's a little tame word, I think.
Okay. Well, maybe it is for that, I'll tell you. I mean, what's coming next for you?
I'm a professional fun haver. I enjoy challenging myself behind the wheel. I enjoy the world that we live in here in the automotive industry, and I enjoy working with partners and achieving goals and taking on challenges. And so, you know, through that, you know, I look at these different spaces and ways that I can continue to excite and engage in my audience and other audiences and be in these spaces that are important. And for me, you know, drifting is something I love, and I want to keep doing it in some capacity into the future. But I've really taken a liking to Ultra 4. And I've teamed up with Lauren Healy. We formed the Fun Haver Off-Road team last year and really started focusing on Ultra 4, King of the Hammers, you know, being out at some of these enthusiast events like the Rubicon and, you know, Moab events and things like that. And I really just love the culture around that. And it's a new challenge for me. Things from drifting have translated well. But I think in the end, you know, what's going on for me is, you know, I'm really growing our team in motorsport and media side, and focused on the RTR vehicle side. And in between, whatever fun things I can do behind the wheel, I'm all in. And, you know, one thing I'm certainly very excited about is, you know, new technologies. We have, obviously, electrification is a really big hot item right now, and the power of electric motors have certainly piqued my interest. So,
you see yourself actually drifting and doing the same kind of things you do in an electric car. Is that going to happen?
I certainly think that it's very possible.
You're definitely going to try, aren't you?
Well, you know, I think that on paper, there's nothing better suited for what we do with drifting. High power, short bursts. I don't think there's nothing much better suited than electric motors. Fully controllable. It's something that I'm certainly looking forward to getting my hands on and checking out. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, technology is constantly getting more attainable. So certainly have our eyes on that as well.
Well, Vaughn, hey, I appreciate you stopping by here at Brembo Red. You're an exciting business. You definitely are a professional fun haver. Thanks for being with us and spending some time with us here at Brembo Red.
Well, thanks for having me, and I appreciate the love, everyone. Have fun.
This is Dan Sandberg. We're at SEMA. We'll be back with more automotive excitement right after this.
When you went car shopping, you meant business. You ace vehicle history searches and test drives. You out salesman to the salesman. Now you've got your wheels. If you manage that, you can get your retirement plan on track. Visiting aceyourretirement.org can help. With 401k tips and smart saving strategies, you'll have the info you need to get more for your future. Go to aceyourretirement.org, because when it comes to speeding past financial challenges, you're an ace. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
We're back at the LA Auto Show, and when it comes to the LA Auto Show, we're talking performance, and there is no one who epitomizes performance more than the gentleman sitting in front of me, Patrick Long. There isn't a wrinkle on his face because of the G-forces he undergoes daily in his job, factory driver, which is with Porsche Motorsports. That's an interesting title. It's not really the factory you drive, right? It's the stuff that comes out of the factory.
Yeah, exactly. It translates as Werksfahrer in German, basically an extension of Weissach and Vlogt, where Porsche does their development and their R&D for street cars. And, of course, their motorsport department has grown out of that. There's not been a year where Porsche hasn't contributed to motorsport in some aspect, so it's a great brand to be a part of.
All right, well, let's go into your garage, because I understand you're working on an interesting project. In terminology for the Porsche fans out there, it's a 993 narrow body project that you're working on, 911. But what is it really about exactly for you?
For me, it's about purity, celebrating the last air-cooled, the 993, a 1996 model. When I close my eyes and I think of sort of that last stand of air-cooled, it's a silver base narrow-body Carrera. A lot of people love the turbo, and I'm a big fan of the 996 turbo, but naturally aspirated two-wheel drive, that's where I'm at, that's where my head's at. So I searched high and low for the perfect car to sort of celebrate that. And everything that I'm doing is non-invasive, it's reversible, it's bolt-on top technology, and it's really, what do we know now? You know, some 25 years later, if we walked into a dealership in 1996, how could we improve on that car but not change the aesthetics and still celebrate the originality?
So it's not an outlaw vehicle like we hear about, right? Or is it?
I think of outlaws as, you know, big wheels and loud colors and wings that don't do anything. For me, I get paid to sit in the seat of a car and tell engineers how to improve a car. So everything that I can tap into, brands like Brembo, where I can take a cup brake and stuff it into a OEM stock 17 wheel and add some jewelry, add some performance, and add some storyline, that's what I'm about. I don't really need to change colors and add graphics. I'm more thinking, how does the user experience from the driver become more emotional? How does the performance go up? But how do I still celebrate the original lines of what I think are pieces of art that Porsche has produced over the years?
And what year is this car?
This is a 96. It's a C2 or a Carrera 2. Light, narrow. I'm not going fast. I'm not a track guy with my air-cooled cars. It's more about going out on the weekends, driving, you know, the coast of Southern California. And if we get into the canyons and somebody's giving me a hard time in something modern, I have to be able to hold my own.
And the sound, right? I mean, the air-cooleds have a very, very unique sound to them, don't they?
They do. It's that thrusty, naturally aspirated piece that I really like.
Air-cooled, Luftgekühlt. Tell us about that movement and what it was originally and what it's become, and then maybe you'll give us some insight into what's coming in 2020.
Yeah, Luftgekühlt, or Luft, a little easier to pronounce, is our annual celebration of what air-cooled Porsches are. I found myself a little bit lost with the classic car shows that you think about, sort of your dad's car show. And I wanted to introduce what West LA, outside of the motorsport world, introduced to me as a lifestyle event, and then merge it with some of the most beautiful air-cooled cars, both street and race. But it's not all about show and shine. It's not about perfection. It's about telling the complete story from a $5,000 914 that's rusty and ratty that a kid bought out of the Craigslist and had modified it in his garage, all the way up to a $10 million unthinkable 917 that you might only see in a magazine.
So tell us exactly what happened last year, because that to me was probably the best event you've had.
Yeah, Lufkin Colt's meant to be an adventure. It's meant to be different, and it's a journey through not only Porsche and vintage Porsche, but also our hosts and taking you to places that are different. Architecture is key for us. We place our cars. Jeff Swart is a great friend and partner of the program, and he really creative directs these cars so that they're Instagrammable and everybody gets their own angle and their own vision on these cars. But we don't want to just see parking lots full of cars and lines of cars. That to us is not what we're about. So trying to find somewhere that 10,000 people can make it to, park their cars, still be in a community that's not out in the middle of a desert or a golf course or a racetrack. We're trying to go to interesting communities, and the Universal Backlot, to get to your question, is where we threw this year's party. It was May of 2019. The Backlot is a place I grew up on the tram tour of a Southern California kid going to Universal Studios and seeing where Back to the Future was shot and Three Amigos, and, you know, there's probably 100 different movies that were shot on the grounds of where we held Luft, which was just a part of the Backlot at Universal. Such an iconic movie set. And so we wanted to lay Porsches against some of the most famous movie backdrops, and it was a fun day out.
You know, I tell you, I appreciate the invitation last year, and I went, and my first experience as a Porsche owner and a Luft participant. So many great photographic opportunities, and the cars were fantastic, and the backdrops and the sets and the people there, and just the whole atmosphere was fantastic. That brings me to my next question. How do you beat that?
Well, first of all, dates are difficult. You know, I do 20-some race weekends a year, and trying to fit into my schedule has always been one of the hurdles of Luft, and it's no longer about me and my schedule. So we've picked a date, regardless of where my motorsports activities might be. I hope to jet in and at least make the main show. It's hard to find a weekend where there aren't five other car events, but we haven't announced the date or the location. All I would say is expect the unexpected. That's sort of part of the Luft experience and the brand. You got to keep people guessing. We're not big marketers. We don't oversaturate the Instagram feeds with all kinds of propaganda and jargon. It's basically talk to your buddies and figure it out. We're excited. The venue is signed. I'll say it's the end of May so that people can kind of understand where they're looking and new territories to charter. Let's say that.
So how, if I want to participate in this and you're listening to this podcast and you don't know anything about it, how can you get some inside information on it, or at least get on a mailing list or something that you can find out about it?
Yeah, luftgekult.com, LuftGekU. HLT, not an easy one to spell, translates to air-cooled in German. Yeah, luftgekult.com is our website. That's where we post any information first. We're very fortunate that usually the demand is higher than the supply, so there's a little bit of a feeding frenzy to get your car in the show. That's not by design, it's just that we're trying to keep it approachable. The original direction of the show was lay something out for people who aren't Porsche enthusiasts, and let's introduce new people to this world. It's not a closed door old boys world. It's all about bringing people out who might not have an air-cooled car or might not go to car shows regularly, but there's a mailing list that you can sign up there. That's usually where we drop information first, and then we roll it out slowly through our Instagram and our other social media channels, and that's just Luftgekult.
Looking forward to it. Taycan.
Yes.
What do you think of that?
Well, I haven't had my hands on one. I just rolled around the corner and saw that they're about to pull the sheet off of that and give LA its first look. Obviously, it debuted at the Frankfurt Auto Show earlier this summer. I'm excited. We've got some stiff competition and some good drama on the social media channels between that unnamed electric vehicle company who doesn't seem to be too welcoming about the Taycan, and we love a little bit of competition. So this is what drives storylines. It's what drives passion. Porsche is a brand that you aspire to. You follow it and you love it before you might ever have one of those cars, and it's a little bit like those iconic wristwatches. It's something to aim for, and I'm excited that we're entering into this domain. But yeah, they haven't let me drive one yet. There's a rumor that I'm pretty hard on the equipment, so we'll have to get some laps in one on a track.
I'm surprised they haven't let you drive it yet, but on that subject, do you see yourself driving an electric race car for Porsche?
I don't know. I believe it's coming. It's here with the Formula E, but it'll probably be coming in the GT forms. I've seen some other OEMs that have done some touring car championships. It's the way of the future, but at the same time, I'm not scared that motorsport application and racetracks will still be predominantly combustion engines. I think that when you think about how the center of a city is very much where electric cars will be mostly concentrated, and then I think that it will sort of radiate out to the countryside, but I still see the combustion engine OG motorsport application being a big part of motorsport. I talked to McKeel Haggerty last week. We were up at an event at Canepa, and all the research that Haggerty does says that there's plenty of demand and there's plenty of spaces to still go normal racing, but the electric side and following Formula E, Porsche's first year in Formula E this year is very interesting. Of course, they drop it right in the middle of a metropolitan city. As Calvin Fish would say, argy-bargy racing. There's plenty of crashing in action, so that's always good for the TV numbers.
What about your career next year on the racing side? I know you were over in Europe this year racing. What are you doing in 2020?
2020 is signed and sealed and delivered. Again, for this reason, I'm not able to say anything until we get to our Night of Champions, which is the first weekend of December. There, Porsche brings all of their drivers and teams from all over the world, not only from the factory level, but from the customer level. And we sort of have a party at the headquarters, and they announce all the drivers and where they'll be going the year after. I'm very happy with the team and the role, and we'll be racing at least 15 races next year. I'm trying to pull it back just a little bit because there's so many other automotive events and things that I haven't been to that I really want to attend. So lots of bucket list items to get to. I'm not getting any younger, so I want to enjoy it from the motorsport side, but also the classic car side.
Well, Patrick, I'm going to follow you probably for the next day or so to see if I can slip into your Taycan when you get in there to drive it around the streets of L.A. Maybe we'll get some excitement out of it then. Appreciate you stopping by at the Brembo Red Podcast Studio. And of course, always great to hear what's going on with you, with your Porsche projects, and of course, the Luft. And we'll look forward to that in 2020. But thanks for spending some time with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Brembo Red, Dan Sandberg at the LA Auto Show. We'll be back with more from the show right after this.
You're listening to Brembo Red.
When might you be buzzed? When you suddenly love everything.
You guys, I love this song.
I love these nachos.
I love our kickball league. Ugh! I love this guy.
What's your name?
You know what I'd love? A ride when it's time to head out.
If you see a buzzed warning sign, call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
I love your car. Is this real leather?
And welcome back to Brembo Red. This is Dan Sandberg, and I promised you that we would go backstage in NASCAR. That's the purpose of Brembo Red, to bring all of you auto people back where you really want to be. If you're into NASCAR, I don't think you'd want to be any other place than on Papa Joe Boulevard here in North Carolina. About how far are we, you think?
Oh, the racetrack?
Yeah.
Oh, man, we're less than a half mile away from Charlotte Motor Speedway here at Hendrick Motorsports.
So some of you would recognize that voice, and if you're going to interview a crew chief in this business, somebody who knows what goes on in every single race, you got to be talking about Chad Knauss, probably one of the most successful crew chiefs here in NASCAR. Thank you very much for spending time with us here on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to it.
Let me ask you this for our racing fans that maybe aren't as familiar with the hierarchy and what goes on in racing. Tell us real briefly what a crew chief does.
Basically, I think the closest parallel or the easiest parallel to draw is if you look at a football head coach and you see what their responsibilities are with their driver, it would be similar to a quarterback. Let's say, for instance, your group of guys that go to the racetrack with you, I'd say that's kind of your offensive line. They're the guys that are making the plays, adjusting the race car, getting it prepared, executing the race. And then the group of people that you've got that stay home and build your race cars and get them prepared for the next week and the upcoming events, that'd be kind of like your defensive line. So we've got a similar amount of people as you would at a football team. I think every car number comprises of similar people, of about 60 to 70 people or so in that range. So, you know, football teams are thinking about 100 pretty consistently. So I'm not too far off that. Crew chiefs are responsible for laying out the strategy, the manufacturing of the race cars, the components, the setup of the cars, all of that. And I'm not saying each crew chief does each one of those jobs, but ultimately they are accountable for all of that and the performance of the race team. We obviously have our engineers that are similar to like our offensive coordinator, like on a football team, or a defensive coordinator on a football team. They help us with different areas to make sure that we're getting the best components and the best strategy for our cars.
I'm glad you used the analogy of a football team, because that gets me to my next question, which is, when it comes to a race, what's your philosophy about who's the boss? Is it the driver or is it the crew chief?
I don't know if it's necessarily a boss relationship. At least it hasn't been for me. We've built all of the teams that I've been fortunate to be a part of around the teamwork aspect. And again, I think I referenced the crew chief as the head coach. So he's the guy making the calls, making the strategies with feedback from other people on the team and feedback from the driver. The driver, his responsibility is to execute, obviously, not tear up the equipment, make sure that he's taking care of the race car, putting himself in a position to advance forward in the race. And then the crew chief and the engineers, they try to make the calls. So it's not a boss type scenario. It's a teamwork and how you get that thing done.
All right, you've been the crew chief of one of the most successful drivers out there, obviously. Jimmy Johnson, 7 championships. And now you're the crew chief for William Byron, who's one of the younger drivers.
Yeah.
Is there a difference in how you do your job with a driver like Jimmy and then William?
Oh, of course. But you have to realize that when Jimmy and I started, it was 18 years ago, you know, well before the 7 championships, well before the first race win, well before any of that. So the way that we structured the team and worked together at that standpoint isn't significantly different than what we're doing with William right now. But it's different. You know, Jimmy was, I'd say, more of a peer at that standpoint, because we both hadn't had much success. We were both trying to establish where we were in the industry and what we could do here in Hendrick Motorsports. It was a little different from that standpoint. But the way that you approach it, and you coach the driver and you teach the driver the racetracks, techniques, things of that nature, isn't so unlike what we were doing back then.
You know, when you see a driver like William Byron, who's young, I mean, he is pretty young.
Yeah, 21 years old, man.
Does it give you hope that the younger generation is going to remain interested in cars and racing? I mean, we hear so much about, you know, all the younger generation wants to do is play with their iPhones.
I think you ask any football team, baseball team, basketball team, racing organization, anybody that has children or younger siblings, that's exactly what they would say. Get off your phone. Go outside and play sports. Go grab a basketball. Go do that. That's kind of the norm. But then I think back, our parents and grandparents complained about what we did too. So it's completely, you know, it's not so unlike. But I do feel like that there's a strong young group of people that really enjoy motorsports still. If you look at the crowds that we get at the racetracks, they're huge, man. And yeah, are we getting necessarily 150,000 people like we used to? No. But are we getting 80? Yes. I mean, that's a lot of people.
Still,
right?
Still a good showing.
Yeah, man. I mean, trust me, it's still difficult to get out of the racetracks, you know, because of the traffic. So I think that the younger generation is just a little bit different. And I think as we continue to progress, we've got a new generation race car coming out in 2021, which I think everybody's pretty excited about. It's going to take our cars and our sport into the next realm of technology, more so than maybe where we have been. We have been a little bit hesitant, a little bit reserved to change in some of our respects. I think this is going to help us get out there and get in the forefront of what it is the OEMs are using, what it is that the younger generation is seeing on the street. You know, everybody's used to seeing this type of caliper, this type of, you know, the big red Brembo caliper on their wheels. You know, they're used to seeing that type of thing with the bigger wheels and tires, and that's what we're going to have with our new race cars.
From a crew chief standpoint, what do you really want to see in that new car from NASCAR?
What I'm excited about is it's got some real race car components. The rack and pinion steering, the independent rear suspension, the bigger wheels and tires, the bigger brakes, a lot of the things that we're building, it's more modular. A lot of the stuff that's going into that is true race car-esque. Now, I've seen a lot of generation of cars come through, probably 5 in my career, which is an awful lot. But the new one is you're removing some of the older technology. You're removing some of the manual steering boxes. You're removing the trailing arm type rear suspension. You're getting rid of that for a new wave of way to engineer, tune, and design the race cars.
Let's talk about brakes, since this is the Brembo Red podcast.
Yeah.
How have brakes really changed since you started in the business, and how you use those brakes during the race?
From when I started? Oh, man. I mean, we had, I think, the first cool short track caliper I had came off of an airplane. We went from, you know, two piece calipers to monoblock calipers to the, you know, the calipers that are all, you know, machined out to where there's better airflow. You know, we went from single piston to two piston to four piston to six piston, you know, all of that. You know, there's been huge changes. I would say that the component, the way it is right now, especially from the Brembo respect, is pretty tried and true. The industry has kind of culminated to this style of design. And it's a really good product. You know, we've had a lot of success with it. We just left Martinsville last week.
Congratulations on that second place, by the way.
Thank you. Had a great run. Really happy with the performance. I think it was our best race to date. I really do think it was very forthtelling of what William's capable of doing in this team, to be able to finish second there and race the way that we did. And I just got finished debriefing with William, and he actually said that our brakes were great all weekend long. So that was a really nice thing to hear.
Tell us in a somewhat non-technical style, and you can throw a little tech talk in there if you want. But, you know, you look at short tracks, you look at road courses, you can kind of say, yeah, I can understand what brakes do.
Yeah.
You know, they stop the car. But in NASCAR, brakes are used for a lot of other functions than just stopping, right? Especially on some of the speedway courses, right?
Absolutely, yeah. The brakes are a tool. The way the drivers manipulate the brakes is a tool. You can change the handling characteristics of the car with just the brake application itself. We take it to another level. We work the front and rear brake bias. There are teams that work bias from individual wheels to maybe left to right bias. There's a lot of different PAG configurations that you can run, so there's a ton of things that we can do. If your car's too loose getting into the corner, you can add some front brake bias percentage to it, and the car will get tighter. So if the car is tight in the corner, you do the opposite. You throw the lever to the rear and give it some rear brake bias, and the car will kind of rotate for you as you apply the brakes. So there's a lot to be had there, and I think with the confines that we have with the wheel diameter that we use right now, which obviously limits our rotor size, and what we can do for actual clamping force, it's pretty impressive what these cars are actually capable of doing.
There is some technology going on, even in those old cars.
It's amazing, man. It's amazing. It's, you know, you have to think about it, right? So we metal turns red at 1400 degrees, roughly. All you have to do is watch a race at Richmond or a road course or Martinsville or any of these tracks, and when you see the metal red at 1400 degrees, you're just a step away from molten. So we are melting the steel. We're bringing the steel almost to a liquid at that point, and the cars are still stopping.
That's really amazing.
Isn't it great?
You know, when you think back on your career, you see where you are right now. I mean, do you get up in the morning and you think, man, this has been quite a run? I mean,
yeah, every day, three times a day. Every time I get upset about something, I'm like, man, I'm doing it all right. You know, so I really love my job. It's the coolest thing in the world. You have to think about if you get up every day and all you have to do is go and try to make a race car go faster, it can be frustrating and very rewarding at the same time. You know, our decisions are based off of tenths of a second, which is amazing that we're chasing after that on a daily basis. It seems almost ludicrous, you know, if you think about it, a tenth of a second. Most people can't even identify with what a tenth of a second is. They look at the qualifying sheet and think, oh, whew, geez, you're a tenth off and you qualified 15th. You know, like, yeah, that's a huge, huge mountain to climb. But in all reality, it's like that. That's all we're looking for. But I can tell you this. I wake up every morning, not easily, especially as I've gotten older. It's harder. You know, I hit snooze maybe twice. But as soon as my feet hit the floor, I get in the shower, I get dressed, and I drive down the highway to Hendrick Motorsports as fast as I possibly can. So I really love coming into this place. I've been here for a long time. Started here in 1993, and, you know, obviously being here in 2019 is quite a run.
Did you ever think about what you would do if you weren't racing?
You know, I grew up around motorsports. I grew up around racing, and I really wanted to do it. I had a short stint where I was a mechanical engineer for a company out of Columbus, Ohio. Was a draftsman. Now, back then, that's when drafting was with pen and paper and a T-square and all that kind of jazz and not on computers. And I remember I was doing that, and I'm like, man, this isn't what I want to be. I don't want to be in there. I want to be outside at the racetrack, smelling the rubber, burning fuel, and doing all the stuff that we're not supposed to be doing sometimes right now. But no, man, I love it.
Well, Chad, I really appreciate you spending some time with us. I know we're going into the playoffs. You're pretty busy right now.
Yeah.
You know, we really appreciate you spending time with us and giving us some insight of what goes on in this building and what goes on at the track.
Right on. Glad to be here.
Thanks. This is Dan Sandberg, and you're listening to Brembo Red. Stay tuned. Mike Messina is coming up to give us an update on what's going on in racing. Be back in a bit.
This is Brembo Red.
Welcome back to the Dog Show. Up next, we have Satchmo. Satchmo is a member of the Shelter Pet Group.
That's right, a group known especially for their couch snuggling, ball chasing, face licking, and of course, companionship. Now, let's see him in action.
Look how he makes eye contact with his person.
That's actually known as the treat stare.
How intuitive, and now he appears to be excitedly turning in circles.
Ah, the happy dance will come in with this group.
But really, the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Satchmo is to meet one.
Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt.
Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
It's time for the racing update here on Brembo Red.
Thank you, David. We are back at the LA Auto Show, and in front of me is our own version of David Hobbs here at Brembo Red. It's Mike Messina from the Brembo North American Racing Group. How are you?
I'm good. That might be a little bit of a stretch.
So how are you?
I'm doing great. We're wrapping up a lot of championships. Most everything has been decided, and those aren't even done yet for the most part. Decided.
Checking out your suitcase to see what kind of condition is in and whether or not you'll use it next year when you go back out on the road again.
Has some miles, but it'll hold up another year.
Okay, good to hear. So let's shoot on over to NASCAR. Talk about what happened there at the end of the season.
Boy, I'll tell you, going into Miami with the final four, at least for the first half of that race, it was Martin Truex all day. I think he led all but one lap of the first stage and just kind of another dominating performance. And then, kind of fell victim to some of the same things that the other three guys fell victim to, were just sort of, pit road mistakes. That put Kyle Busch out front. And once he got out there, he was gone. He just checked out. And it was interesting. It put Truex back. He put him about a lap down, and he spent the entire race passing the entire field. He got up to second. He got up within about 4.5 seconds towards the end, and that was it. He used up the car, and Kyle Busch won the championship. And look at Kyle Busch is a polarizing guy. You know, if you're not part of Rowdy Nation, then everybody seems to have an opinion one way or the other, and it's pretty strong about Kyle Busch. But at the end of the day, he's just got a raw talent. He's a contender at any track we go to, and when you consider how many races he's won, I think he's like 7th or 8th on the all-time wins list now. It's a little bit surprising to think that this is only his second championship.
And the Hendrick guys had a pretty good year overall. They were in the running for quite a while, weren't they?
Going into the playoffs, Hendrick had 3 or 4 cars in there. You know, we never did get a win for William Byron in the 24 car, which was a little bit unfortunate, but that kid is there. He's right on the cusp of it. It's just
we're going to see some good
time.
Things with him
it's
next
a question
year,
of time.
I think.
But, in general, people like to make a lot of news about the fact that a team that big and, with that much depth to be struggling the way that they are. And really, I don't think it says anything about Hendrick. I just think it says something about the level of competition in that series.
Let's jump over to MotoGP, one of my favorite series.
MotoGP is all about a guy named Marquez.
Huh. I don't know how many years I've been watching that kid. He's not really a kid anymore. He's middle age, I think, in the MotoGP circuit at this point. But it's unbelievable. I mean, he just doesn't show any age at all, right? The fear is not in that kid.
He just doesn't seem to slow down. That's a different breed of those guys. I don't know. I feel like he won everything this year. And then after him, you've got Dovizioso on the Ducati and Maverick Viñales, who could arguably have one of the coolest names in racing, a guy named Maverick. That's just awesome. Racing for Yamaha, who finished up 3rd in the championship points.
I'm glad
this year
to see Ducati, though, at least competing. All right. So many years I was going to Laguna Seca watching them. I mean, it was quite clear that they just weren't doing anything to the bikes to really make them competitive. Mm. I mean, Valentino was running on Ducati for I don't know how many years. And you and I have that discussion all the time as did he waste career years just for being on a bad bike, right?
No, I like it, too. Back in my day when I was into this stuff pretty heavily, I mean, Ducati was always a force. And I think given day, Ducati was always a player, so it's nice. It's nice that they're back.
Let's jump on over to sports car, one of your favorite series, I know.
I mean, I'm a little biased. I mean, I'm a car guy, and sports car has the widest breadth of cars, so yeah, I guess I could say I'm a sports car guy. I like any good form of racing, and so for IMSA, it was a really good year. This year was a really good year for Honda, particularly the Acura brand. Acura DPIs race that are campaigned by Penske Racing won the overall IMSA championship, so it was great to see that happen. Also, the NSX won in GT3 with Michael Schenck Racing, so that was fantastic to see as well. Porsche won in the GTLM category. That's the one I call the knife fight because that is by far the most competitive category of racing, maybe anywhere on the planet next to Formula One. They had a strong showing. They came to fight this year, and they did. On the other side of the news, a little bit bittersweet, was the end of the Ford program, the end of the GTLM program for them. That's a program that we started working with them on in 2015 and then went to Le Mans in 16 and won on the 50th anniversary of that win. That was a big deal for them. It was a big deal for us. It was a big deal really for everybody involved. You've got the movie coming out that just came out, Ford versus Ferrari, and that tells the story of the catalyst for that took place back in the 60s.
When you look at the Ford program, all right, and we're going to have some guests on from Ford, we're going to put them on the spot and ask them, where do you think Ford is going to be going with racing? Given that they released the Mach-E here at the LA Auto Show, a famous Mustang SUV we've been hearing about for a long time, You think Ford's heading over to electrified racing somewhere, some series like Formula E or some type of electrified sports car racing? What do you think?
So the commercial side of me says probably yes, because they have to, right? That's just what you have to do. You have to go where the customers are. You have to go where the demand is.
But this is a company that's basing their whole strategy, right, on mobility / electrification, right?
Yeah.
So you figure that's where they're going to go, right?
I feel like they will, but I also feel like Ford has never lost touch with where they've come from. And so the optimist in me says that they're not going to just go completely electric. Not yet, anyway. Maybe they will as a company, but I feel like they're going to have an enthusiast brand that they're going to want to maintain, whether that's Mustang or something else. I think that's going to stick around.
All right, let's go on over to IndyCar. And I don't even want to talk about who won IndyCar. You can mention it if you want. I'll let you do that.
Don't want to talk about the fact that Joseph Newgarden won IndyCar, the IndyCar championship.
Well, you just did, so you got it done. But I think the biggest news in IndyCar was our buddy Roger Penske went ahead and bought that series. I think that's fantastic. I don't know how you feel about it.
I'm encouraged. I don't want to. You know what? I don't want to say I'm encouraged, because then it almost sounds like I'm saying the guys that were running it weren't doing all they could. Obviously, that's something that's very near and dear to Roger Penske's heart. And so that being the case, I feel like he might invest a different level of attention in it than he might in just buying another entity. You know, it's not like buying another car dealership or something like that. This is something that's a passion of his. And so I'm really, really interested to see how that dictates the moves he makes going forward. You know, he's done some great things. He's walked into some great racing venues and made some investments and improved a lot of things everywhere he's gone. So, like I said, I'm hopeful.
Overall, how would you rate 2019 as a racing year, particularly for Brembo?
For Brembo, I'd say it was a really good year. We had a lot of challenges, and there was a lot of really, really good work done by our own team and our partners that work with us. Really happy about this year. Next year is going to be very similar. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, thanks, Mike. I appreciate you spending some time with us here on Brembo Red. It's good to have an update, I think, at every episode on what's going on in racing. I want to thank our guest, Von Gittin Jr., for drifting me around SEMA, and, of course, for spending some time with us here on Brembo Red. Thanks to Patrick Long from Porsche Motorsports for joining us from the LA Auto Show, and a special thanks to Hendrick Motorsports for allowing us a few minutes with Chad Knaus during the NASCAR playoffs, who took us down pit row for a crew chief's view of NASCAR. You know, I had a great time on this episode of Brembo Red, and I hope you enjoyed it too, enough to subscribe to this podcast. Just head over to the iTunes App Store or to Google Play and hit that subscribe button. You'll love what we have coming down the road for you here in our next episodes. This is Dan Sandberg from Brembo North America. Please take care and have a safe and happy holiday season, and come back and join us soon here on Brembo Red.
You've been listening to Brembo Red with your host, Dan Sandberg. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to podcast@us.brembo.com. Brembo Red is produced and copyrighted by Brembo North America.